Hello, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 189th. My name's Dick Newman, the episode's called Robert Dudley, and there's been not one but two bits of good news this week. Can you believe it, my dear listener? Two bits of good news for me to share with you. Firstly, a war has ended. Now, war starting is pretty common and not good news, but war's ending, pretty rare, and of course it is good news. The war in question is the war between New Zealand and Afghanistan. And after 20 years, New Zealand said, yeah, nah, we'll call it a draw. We've had enough. So they packed up their stuff and headed home to New Zealand. Now, there was only six of them left in Afghanistan by the time they made the decision, but point is, it's a war that's ended. New President Sleepy Joe, of course, has said, yeah, we're going all the way with Afghanistan. We don't care if we're there for 150 fucking years, so long as we keep funding that war industry. The other bit of good news this week is there's a whole lot less terrorists on the planet than there was a week ago. How did this happen, you ask? Did the terrorists sort of just turn nice, or did the US kill them all? What happened to these terrorists? Well, it goes like this. Sleepy Joe decided that the Houthis in Yemen are no longer terrorists. So there's about 100,000 less terrorists on the planet than there were a few days ago, and what we can learn from this, my dear listener, is that there's nothing to be scared of with terrorists, because it's nothing to do with their actions, it's all to do with the US and their foreign policy. And on that happy news, let's circle back. Yeah, just a little bit of J.S. Bach there, the Orchestral Suite number 3 in D major, better known to us as Getting Some Air on Your G String. Now, last week we briefly met Sir Francis Walsingham, who will be Betty's chief spook. Then we had a look at how things were going in France. Totally shit, really. They've got their problems with the Reformation and the Huguenots. Frankie Snotnose died, making Mary Queen of Scots and She Wishes England a widow. Catherine de Medici has shown us that she could outsmart the men and is firmly in charge, while the Scotty Queen was left in a darkened room, boo-hoo-hooing. In England, it's going pretty well with religion. Betty is the governess of the church in England rather than the head of the church, but that's just marketing and bullshit to appease the conservative lords. Pretty tough for them to consider that a woman could be the head of the church. Next thing you'd want them to be priests or something stupid like that. She has the same powers as Henry, Ted and Mary had. She's moving very slowly on churchy stuff, telling returning Protestants to shut the fuck up if they've got new ideas, and she told John Calvin to piss off with his ideas about some sort of universal Protestant church. What a dick of an idea, Calvin. England will be doing its own thing, thank you very much. I like to think that Betty, being rather smart, knows it's impossible to make people happy about religion. On that basis, she is creating an English church that looks to retain some of the old church stuff while still being Protestant. This is making the more fervent Protestants unhappy, but hey, if they think for 2 seconds, they'll realise that this is way, way better than Mary's policy of setting them on fire. Let's see what they are not happy about. They're not happy about priests have to be celibate. She's not rushing into getting rid of the statues of baby Jesus being tortured to death, nor is she rushing into getting rid of the popish altars. She will eventually swap these over for communion tables. That's nicer, isn't it, my dear listener? A table where you can have some bread and wine rather than an altar where something must die to provide us blood sacrifice to the big angry sky monster. Also unhappy for the Protestants is Betty wanting churchy types to keep wearing the fancy pants studs. Churchy tops will refer this to Peter the Martyr. And, I know some of you are saying, hey, Dick, Peter the Martyr is dead as a doornail. first abbot of Jamaica, even though he never went there. But no, that's Peter Martyr de Anghiera. I'm talking about the less famous Peter Martyr Vermagili, Italian reformer, who'd run away from Italy, so he ran all the way to England, only to find Teen King dead and Mary Queen of the bonfires, so he ran away to Zurich. This Peter Martyr turned his magnificent mind to the problem of whether the real physical baby Jesus turns up when the magician does the magic trick. He decided baby Jesus doesn't actually leave heaven, so it's just the wisp of him that turns up, the smell of him or something. He also came up with the double predestination view. Don't be impressed, my dear listener. They'd actually come up with that in the 9th century, so it was hardly an original idea. Double predestination says that in regard to you, my dear listener, that's right, you, God had determined before you were even born whether you were going to heaven or to hell. It's all done and dusted. The decision has been made, so off you go. Hit the booze, get into the drugs, party your heart out. Bang away with whichever willing adults you care to, because it makes zero difference to your afterlife. Mind you, instead of double predestination, it could be corporate election, which is an open theist, non-traditional Arminian view of election, that predestination is corporate, so God has selected a church, say, the Southern Baptist Convention, and said, hey, that is actually the right one, so you only get to heaven if you happen to be a Southern Baptist Convention member. So in this hypothetical case, you get to go to heaven, but on earth there is a bloody good chance that you got sexually abused by one of their very randy pastors. I should get back to Betty, and a desire that senior churchy guys have a fancy frocks to wear. Churchy guys referred the matter to Peter Martyr, who had a good hard think, and said, hey guys, could be worse, and if you resign over wearing nice ball gowns, then that would open the door to churchy types who sympathise with the fucking Lutherans, or worse, Pope types, who we all know love to be the belle of the ball with super fancy duds. For common smelly types at the moment, it's still all a bit confusing. Which is the old religion, and which is the new? While we may not have been fussed on the Catholic fat cat churchy types being rich and overfed, at least they had that kind of English belief stuff going on. Like the maypole and the wise woman and the cunning men and the after-church fun stuff like the boozer and dicing and bowling and cards and cakes and aisles and all that might be lost if these serious Protestants get going. Protestants are into sobriety, chastity, respectability and thrift. Who wants that shit? On top of all that, we have the problem of change. People do not like change. So the challenge for Betty is to ensure that people don't lose the old magic. The fairies and superstitions, yeah, we don't want to lose that to the new religion. Betty then seems to be on the right track, not wanting to force Catholics or ordinary types into a new unpalatable religion. This is where it's very handy for Betty to have guys like William Cecil with his brains trust of friends and relatives. Cecil's brother-in-law, Sir Nicholas Bacon, is a great believer in mass education. And I hear you, Sir Nicholas. If, for example, the USA had decided to teach critical thinking to its population, say, 40 years ago, then something like QAnon could probably not exist. But the US has always been reluctant to spend on education. Smells a bit like socialism to them. Not that they seem to know what socialism is, really. To help Betty out further, this brain's trusts have been working for Mary as well, so there's no sudden shift in power. Of course, there will be tension, and that tension will come from the Commons in Parliament. We have some guys who are starting to look like those scary Puritans. And they will introduce legislation, stuff like senior churchy types can't wear stylish purple frocks. No, they must wear plain grey frocks. What is it with our white men and fashion? I don't know. Then they'll look to get one of the versions of the Common Book of Prayer back as mandatory. It was the version that had really pissed off the Catholics. These guys will be known as the ministers of Lucifer, and Betty will not be happy with them. Perhaps a big item on the minds of our parliamentarians, both the Commons and the Lords, was the lovely land and buildings. Henry and Cromwell had handed some out, or perhaps sold it to them at bargain prices, either way. Then Teen King Ted, or perhaps his regents, handed out more. Then Mary took back the stuff that Teen King Ted had handed out. for our parliamentarians then, who gives a fuck how we do the magic show? We just want to make sure we keep what we've got and get back the stuff that Mary took away. With all this then, it would be unsurprising to see that there is no total unity in the voting. We've got 77 lords, with 24 wanting to keep the old Latin magic show, and 17 of those lords who are churchy types not wanting to see the Queen as the head of the church in England. Some want the communion in both kinds, others want just the bread without yeast. Yes, it's still rather messy. Parliament will be prorogued for the annual Easter egg hunt and to give Betty and Cecil a bit of breathing space to see what can be rigged. Those 17 churchy lords can go to a nice religious debate, which will be rigged in favour of Protestant ideas. Now that will allow us to pop the Bishop of Lincoln and the Bishop of Winchester into the slammer, where their votes don't count a little bit. Those two guys being in the slammer will help when the uniformity bill comes to the Lords. Vote will be 21 for and 18 against, with one abbot inexplicably absent. If he'd been there along with the bishops, then it would have been a tie, and that would have meant the legislation would have failed. So well done, Betty and Cecil, for just removing those couple of recalcitrant bishops. A bishop or two will still refuse to acknowledge Betty as head of the church, so they can be sacked. Great. Thanks, guys, for doing that. And we'll just replace those with Protestants who will acknowledge Betty. Now that that's tidied, oh, I shouldn't have said head of the church. That was very bad of me. She's not the head of the church. She's the governess of the church, isn't she? Oh, dear me. Anyway, it's all tidied up. Betty can get to the act of exchange, meaning she can get back those lovely first fruits of the bishopric. You might remember that's the first year's income from the bishopric, and take whatever property she likes when a bishopric becomes vacant. Betty has made a start to getting the cash flowing through the royal accounts again. So Betty is settling nicely into the title Supreme Governor of the Church along with our English. It satisfies Catholic types that she is not the Supreme Head but the Supreme Governor, and it satisfies Protestant types who have always been a bit worried that really it should be Baby Jesus who is the Supreme Head, but if not, then surely it should be a human with the all-important penis and testicles and not some vagina-type girly thingy. Yes, we certainly don't want girl magicians. Slowly, our churches are seeing the statue of the tortured baby Jesus and his mum with the magical hymen, and because things are better in threes, a statue of St. John all going to be replaced by the royal arms. That's a nice message there. The Queen and the Church are one. The act of uniformity means going to the magic show is compulsory on Sundays and holy days. And we've got a new publication of the Book of Common Prayer with no radical changes. I must say, though, I do feel for ordinary magicians out there in the countryside. It's to be the communion both ways. Okay, fine, we get that. The punters get the bread without yeast and the slug of house bread. But with the words, we need to remember the 1549 bit, which goes, "The body of our Lord Jesus Christ, which was given for thee, preserve thy body and soul unto everlasting life." And then, to finish that sentence, you've got to switch to the 1552 bit, which says, "Take and eat this in remembrance, that Christ died for thee, and feed on him in thy heart by faith with thanksgiving." So I feel for the common churchy types who are just looking to make a living, really, and save the odd soul along the way. But this is actually a very smart move if we look at the theology. The body of our Lord Jesus Christ, which was given for thee, may mean that the bread without yeast has turned into the real baby Jesus, or it may not mean that at all. It's ambiguous. This should satisfy both the Catholics and the Lutherans who believe it is the real baby Jesus, while also satisfying the Protestants who say it's all bullshit and the bread without yeast just smells like the baby Jesus or something or other. Who cares? The main thing for the Protestants was the other bit, the take and eat this in remembrance, which makes the magical trick just a memorial. Brilliant. All I can conclude is well done that whoever who worked out combining the 1549 and the 1552 sentences was perhaps the real magic trick here. It's pretty much made it impossible for anybody to complain about the whole thing. Protestants can then focus on being unhappy about the ornaments rubric, which is the thing that keeps the churchy types in the pretty frocks, whether they are performing magic tricks or they're just off to the boozer for a bottle of brandy or two. It also ties in that they keep the papal candlesticks and crosses and bits and pieces. Our returning Protestant exiles are also on about music now. Fuck 'em. They don't want any of this nice new churchy music. They want to go back to the Gregorian chant type shit. No electric guitars, no synthesizers, no drum kits, no light shows. All that stuff is idolatry. Hillsong with their bloody idolatry. Do you think we should tell them it's idolatry? I don't know if their marketing people will be too happy with that. Penny will start backing down on some stuff. Clergy may be able to be married, but prospective wives will need to be examined by the local bishop and two justices of the peace. The priest might want to marry the local slutty hot widow, but no, we want to ensure that they choose modest, chaste maidens. Betty was forced into that because priests were just setting up house with women. Let's have proper words. Because there hath grown offence and some slander to the church by lack of discreet and sober behaviour in many ministers of the church, both in choosing of their wives and undiscreet living with them. Yeah, see, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's pretty difficult to stop men from wanting to bang women. And look, it's going to be a new magic book. Now, this one was mainly done by the Protestants who had left England under Mary. It's known as the Geneva Bible, which you can still buy today. It comes complete with a scriptural study guide and aids to help you cross-reference stuff. It's also illustrated with maps, tables and pretty pictures. The language has been changed to more forceful and vigorous, and it's got a nice bit of John Calvin flavour in it. This version of the magical book will go down really well with funsters like John Knox, and it'll be a super hit with the Puritans who are just about upon us. Oh, dear me. Those humans who will end up on a ship named the Mayflower will have this version of the magic book with them. King Jim I will, of course, give it the boot in favour of the King Jim I, less Puritan version. Well, let's get our heads out of magic and try to pretend the Puritans aren't coming just yet. I don't know, what will we talk about? Maybe money? I'm not sure. Betty Stad, the mad Welsh king, had debased the currency because he was a big fat dickhead who just wanted to spend money he didn't have on stupid foreign wars. The debasement really fucked over the economy, making life pretty shit for common smelly types, and it got worse under Ted, with those dukes, Ted Seymour, Somerset, and John Dudley, Northumberland, spending on wars and allowing corruption to go on in the government. Perhaps I should say more than normal corruption. Mary then chipped in by sending cash that England certainly could not afford to Spanish Phil for his foreign wars, and lost our trading port of Calais in the process. That's problematic. That's our big trading port. A treaty had been made after all that between England, France and Spain. Should have been called the We're All Too Broke to Keep Fighting Treaty, because that's what it really was. None of them could afford to keep going. In this, we English have a face-saving clause saying Calais will be handed back after 8 years, or France will pay compensation for it. I can't see the Frenchies ever handing it back. There was a bit of an incident in all that treaty negotiations. The Frenchies raised the question as a legal matter, what was the meaning of their obligation to the Crown of England when it's just a bit uncertain who is the rightful possessor of the Crown? Oh dear. It's actually a legal question, so our guys will be looking to get a nice legal answer and refer some matters back to England. Now, Betty will show us that she's got that good old Plantagenet rage. Not at the Frenchies, no, it'll be at our guys, who will cop a mental scarring that will stay with them for their whole lives. Whatever the ministers of other crowns might say, she was deeply displeased that her own servants would allow others to speak without due reprehension or misliking, or that they should be so foolish as to ask her pleasure in a matter which might have been performed by any of you, that we may nor ever will permit any over whom we have rule or may have to make doubt, question, or treaty of this matter. Yes, gentlemen, let us all be in zero doubt at all that Betty has the right bum for the big chair. The treaty will be signed, so for the government it's good news. We've got England out of a problem that this Queen and this Queen's government didn't create. Still, we'll be feeling uneasy because we're worried that the Catholic countries may all manage to get themselves together and then come and build up Protestant countries like us. Not only that, but we're pretty sure that France, under the control of the Guise brothers, will be looking to restore the whole of Europe to the papacy, and that they will start with England. Thanks then must go to the De Guise brothers because they've just helped unite Catholics, Protestants and Lutherans or anyone else in England. Who cares about religion when we think we're under threat from foreigners? One thing that will certainly unite Republicans and Democrats in the US is if Sleepy Joe takes them to war with Iran. They'll just all come together and say, this is just terrific, we love it. It's like that in England right now. Who cares if you're Democrat or Republican? Let's unite to stick it up the Frenchies. Cecil will come up with a plan. Let's convince the Scotties that they should enact legislation to say that Mary Queen of Scots can have no power in Scotland so long as she is Queen of France as well. Scotland should be run by a council elected by the Scottish Parliament. No Frenchies allowed to hold any office whatsoever in Scotland or to spend Scottish money. Idolatry to be banished in Scotland. Mary and Frankie Snotnose to agree to this, and if they don't, then Mary can be out with the Lord Arran being king with English backing. Cecil's argument to get this going is that he'll say there's a unique set of circumstances right now that aren't likely to ever come up again. We could get a permanent peace with the Scotties. The downside, if we don't act, is that we could find a big bunch of Frenchies on the northern border. We, that is, we English and the Scotties, all need to be Protestants together on the island of Britain, and then we can all live happily ever after, nicely united. Cecil will win out, so we get those English troops going to Scotland, and the death of Mary of Guise and a triumph for Cecil. We've got a good treaty with Scotland, and the bulk of the Frenchies have been sent home. This has been a hard chore for Cecil. Betty, like your podcaster, is not into stupid foreign wars and was rather reluctant to send troops to Scotland. Betty also held the principle that it was against God's law to assist people against their monarch or government. Betty only relented because she saw the alternate course as perhaps being a risk to England. Betty will insist that any legislation or declarations that the congregation make, they're to declare their loyalty to Mary, Queen of Scots. They're also to urge Mary to no delight in the unjust and dishonourable usurpation of the arm, style and title of other kingdoms. Meaning, take those English lions off your arms, Mary. Betty will also want any hint that Lord Arran or James Stuart can be King of Scotland to be removed from any documents. Betty was also against the religion of the congregation, and fair enough, that John Knox had been running the magical stuff up there, and that's that John Knox who'd written his book about girlies being just awful and certainly not fit to run a country. For Betty, the Scotties are into the radical type Protestant stuff, so there'll be no mention of religion in any documents. Now, it's not only Betty who was against stupid foreign war. Here's Lord Keeper Bacon. England cannot fight a war. France, four times larger, has not only men and money, but could hire German mercenaries, while England is depopulated and impoverished. Not only does the Queen lack funds to pay her debts, but her nobility, gentry, and commons share this poverty. At home there is much to fear from those of rank, discontented for religion's sake, a formidable array, and those who take themselves to have had their credit or living decayed. Abroad England is without reliable allies, and so on and so on. Yeah, he's pretty much summed it up there. The only good news for Bacon was that he figured France was a bit tied up for the next 18 months or so. Therefore, he recommended indirect and secret aid to the Scotties. Cecil's argument will win, so after urging Betty to find herself a good man to marry, they'll go about raising cash to send that army to Scotland. The carrot and stick argument won out, the stick being the dreaded De Guise brothers, and the carrot being that Mary, Queen of Scots, was sickly, Frankie Snotface was sicklier, and we're all happily hoping they'll both die nice and young. With the marriage thing, nobody is taking Betty seriously with this virgin queen business. Just a young woman being fanciful, they all reckon. Phil was discarded, and now has Frenchy Betty. The Scandinavians are insane, so they're out, but the council still like the look of Charles, son of Ferdinand, Holy Roman sausage maker. Phil is also pushing for this blessed union. In come the envoys, so that Betty can say, no way, fuck off. They'll report, things are looking promising. Betty just told us to fuck off and... not
suck my dick and choke on it. Fuck you.
Lady Sydney, who you might recall is the sister of Robert Dudley and good friend of Betty, will tell the envoys a couple of months later, this is a good time to try again. But why not get that hunky Archduke Charles off his ass and over here for a bit of up close and personal wooing? Perhaps we should feel a bit sorry for the German envoys. It's a ploy. We want the De Guise brothers to think we're on our way to wedded bliss with the German army. It's a better option for some of our guys than supporting Scotties. The Duke of Norfolk will be upfront with the envoy, saying he's now opposing the war in Scotland in favour of a nice wedding treaty with the Archduke Charles. The nobles pushing for a German marriage also see it as an absolutely sure way of putting an end to any marriage thoughts with Robert Dudley, who they still see as a danger, and who I'm supposed to be talking about this week's episode, isn't it? Robert Dudley, that's the name of the episode, yeah. Bit shitty from the Duke of Norfolk. The war in Scotland, we know from previous episodes, will go well for the English, but it didn't seem like that at the time. Mary of Guise had done a really bang-up job of fortifying Leith, and Tom Howard wasn't getting anywhere. Nobody wanted to give Betty the news that the war wasn't going well, but in the end, it was down to Cecil to tell her. Cecil copped an absolute earful, but the Duke of Norfolk, Tom Howard, will get a letter of confidence with a P.S., please just try a little bit harder going at the Scotties. Cecil will have to go to Scotland personally to try for a deal. Pretty brave. There are plenty of courtiers who take the opportunity for a bit of backstabbing while he's gone. Betty is watching men with wagon loads of cash disappearing over the border to Scotland, and she's getting more and more anxious. Betty has zero patience and will be taking it out on the councillors. Cecil will be getting letters saying, hey, mate, can you make a spectacular deal in a big fucking hurry? We're all copying shit here. As we know, Cecil will be making a big spectacular deal. The Scotties sign it, the Frenchies sign it, and Betty says, hang on a tick. Cecil, tell the Frenchies I want Calais back too. No, hang on a tick. Tell the Frenchies I want Calais back and 500,000 gold crowns to soothe the wounds to my dignity when they put those English lions on the arms of Mary, Queen of Scots, and Frankie Snotnose. I know what you're thinking, my dear listener. Cecil has just copped mission totally fucking impossible. But there was a bit in a letter that says, unless you've already done a deal. And Cecil, fortunately, had already done the deal and gotten the signatures on the document. Should we think that Betty has just had a Trump moment in wanting to put in that stupid stuff on the treaty? No, it wasn't anything like that. The Huguenots in France are saying, hey, Betty, if you help us, we'll not only give you Calais back, but also towns in Normandy and Brittany, and that will make you happy, Betty. Cecil will write back to say, hey, look, it was too late. The deal was done, but really, Betty, what were you thinking? We got everything we wanted. Then to put in Calais in cash was a bit rash. That could have dug us deep into a stupid foreign war, and as for the office of the Huguenots, forget about that. That would last about as long as it took Frankie Snotnose to make a deal with his own Protestants. Then we'd be booted out again. So while it wasn't a Trump moment for Betty, then it wasn't necessarily a well-thought-out position either. She's young. She's learning. You can make a deal with Scotty Protestants because religion is settled there, but in France, religion is far from settled. Betty has had a win, but we have to put it down to Cecil. Cecil had managed to drag Betty and the council step by slow step along the path that he'd laid out. The mainstay of his argument was the threat to Betty's silly hat by Mary Queen of Scots, backed by her hard-men Frenchy uncles. Meanwhile, left Mary as a boo-hoo-hooing teenager in a darkened room, recently orphaned and widowed, but she's managed to put the frighteners on Betty, and Betty won't be forgetting that. At the same time, Betty told her own guys, don't be thinking about separating Mary from the Scotty silly hat. Betty believes firmly in the rights of the monarchy, anointed by God stuff, that says she is the Queen of England, Mary is the Queen of Scotties, and nothing should change that, and particularly not Mary looking at the English silly hat. This whole deal then has been crap for Betty. She'd been forced down a path that she didn't really want to go down. She's had to help a bunch of Scotty fuckers disloyal to their own queen and contributed towards those congregation fuckers getting to power in Scotland. That mob of rabid Protestants who hate her for a gender. Betty's been forced to eat a shit sandwich because of circumstances outside her control. Once that's been digested, she can be free to exercise her own will once more. Maybe that was part of her reasoning when she made that last-minute bid to get Calais back. On the council, we've also had a sorting hat exercise to see where the big dicks sit. Chief against Cecil was Henry Fitzalan, 12th Earl of Arundel, who is still in love with Spanish Phil and the Habsburgs. Henry Fitzalan is now the only guy who worked in a big way for Henry, Ted, Mary and now Betty. Yeah, all of them. Arundel's son-in-law, Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk, was also critical of Cecil, so it was a rather smart move to make him the head of the army. That got Tom Howard out of court and into action. Cecil did send a council and some experienced guys with Tom Howard because young Tom was an inexperienced dickhead. He was very good at dressing smartly, but that was about it. Robert Dudley was also grateful to see Tom Howard out of court for a while, given that Howard just bangs on and on about how Dudley is a dead shit. There was our old mate Ralph Sadler, who mainly conducted that war in Scotland. Ralph, you might remember, was Cromwell's man, did some jobs for Henry, then Ted, went into a kind of self-imposed exile under Mary, but then got called back pretty much immediately by Betty. He was about the most knowledgeable guy in England on Scotty affairs, was committed to the Protestant thingy and totally on board with Cecil's objectives. Tom Howard and Ralph Sadler, operating in the north, also caused a shift in northern politics. Mary had dug up the Percy family to be wardens of the north. Betty's councillors are seeing the Percy and Dacre families in the north as a bit untrustworthy. Since we've got a Percy back, we might as well see how he got there. The last one we had anything to do with was Henry Percy, the 6th Earl of Northumberland, who was madly in love with Anne Boleyn. That Henry Percy, you might recall, was sickly and died miserable and childless, aged 35. Now, he had a brother, Tom Percy, but Tom couldn't take on the Earl gig because his head had come off 22 days earlier for being in that pilgrimage of grace. Henry Percy, 6th Earl, did have a nephew, Tom, son of beheaded Tom, and it would be Mary who decided that we would have a Percy Earl of Northumberland again, particularly because Tom Percy was Catholic. She wanted lots of Catholic nobles. Tom Percy had done well under Mary and been at court, but Betty wanted to keep him in the north, away from court, but also doesn't want him to be a big, powerful warden of the north. Dacre is also not to be trusted, but we'll have some handy deaths. Earl of Shrewsbury, Lord President York, for one, and that will allow some reshuffling of jobs and get Betty loyalists into the northern positions of power. Scotland's been sorted and Mary, Queen of Scots, put back in a darkened room to boo-hoo-hoo. So what's next? For Cecily's mate Throckmorton, it's to be help Betty sort out which fat, rich old white men will be getting cash rewards for the Scotty thing, and perhaps help spend money on building up a navy while writing flowery letters to the De Guise brothers to keep them away from us. With the handing out of money to rich old white men, that is both sides of the border. The Scotty nobles who agreed to the peace treaty are also looking for handouts. And Cecil and Throckmorton are in for a rather large surprise. Betty's not thinking about giving anyone any cash at all. She's not thinking about spending money on warships either. And worse of all, she can't see any need to call a parliament. What the fuck do parliamentarians do if there's no parliament? I don't know. Why not bake meat pies for the poor? Do something that's useful and has purpose, you dicks. No, they won't be making meat pies or anything for the poor. They'll be turning their minds to Betty's marriage. Again. It's about wanting an heir to the big chief. If Betty were to die right now, then it would probably be Mary Queen of Scots with those De Guise brothers, or Lady Jane Grey's sister, Catherine Grey. Apart from those two girlies, there are more distant relatives with penises and testicles. Whatever the case, the most likely outcome would be back to civil war, and nobody wants civil war. The other problem, of course, dear lady listeners, is that we delicate men folk are still unable to contemplate a girly ruler ruling stuff without a husband to be that Christ-like figure and guide and help her poor brain to think through complex problems like, what do I want for dinner? We want a man in the picture to set policy direction, otherwise our great nation will lack stability and security. The Scotty congregation will gladly solve our problem by putting up that dickhead Lord Arran. They're thinking Mary, Queen of Scots, is going to wither and die, and that would give Arran the claim to Scotland. Then with the marriage to Betty, we will finally, finally be one United Britain. We, that is the English, Scotties and Welsh, can then all happily go to Ireland, fuck those Irish right over good and proper once and for all times, and be a mighty United Kingdom and a power on the planet Earth. Betty will say, no. So Betty said no, and you are thinking good on you, Betty, for rejecting that total dickwit Arran. But this is more about the part of the plan where Mary Queen of Scots gets shafted one way or another. We found out Betty doesn't like that idea. Mary Queen of Scots is anointed Queen of Scotland, and we don't want to shaft her. Besides, if we turn our attention to the ladies' gossip magazines, handily found in any ladies' hairdressing salon, then we will see that the gossip has it that there is a bun in the royal oven with the name Dudley on it. Shocking, my dear listener. We haven't got over the horror of Amy Rothschild's running with that set of stairs. Her corpse can hardly be cold, and there's this talk of a royal sproglet. What we can see from Dudley's correspondence is that he was keeping in touch with a wide range of people. Catholic conservatives as well as Protestant holy types. People want favours from him, like a bit of information here or some influence there. Dudley is playing smartly. He's not putting himself out. Just humming along, staying in the background and being inoffensive. Things will start to change just before Amy's death. We've got Cecil being a cranky old boy who hasn't been paid and he's got nothing to do. There's no fucking parliament. He's talking about resigning, but he doesn't want to resign unless he can be sure that his mate Throckmorton would replace him. Cecil is frustrated, so will do that rather silly thing. Say something that will get back to Betty, on purpose. In this case, he will say to the Spanish ambassador, he intends to retire, since the Queen's intimacy with Lord Robert would bring ruin to the realm in any case. Worse, of course. Dudley would be better in heaven than here in England. Worse, of course. He will tell the ambassador that Dudley will most likely kill his Mrs. Amy. Cecil won't resign. He'll hang around being miserable with people writing to him saying, don't let Becky marry Dudley. That would be a disaster. God and religion will be out of estimation. The Queen discredited, condemned and neglected, and the country ruined and made prey. If we turn our attention away from the ladies' gossip magazines, we may wish to check out the subreddit, Pommy Nobles Thinking of Rebellion. And there are posts there about Margaret Douglas, daughter of Margaret Tudor, being perhaps Queen of England, with the Earl of Lennox as King. Yeah, we'd forgotten about them, hadn't we, Margaret Douglas and the Earl of Lennox? European gossip magazines no longer speculate on which inbred European big dick will score Betty. They all have it that a secret marriage with Dudley is done and dusted. It's all over. That was after Amy's death, that bit about Betty and Dudley being married. Betty defended Dudley as innocent, but at the same time we have a report that she tore up the patents drawn up for Robert's big promotion to the peerage. It seems that she had been just about ready to make him an earl or something, and then Amy died and that's that. Our timing now says we're about to be hit with events. Frankie Snotface to die, the De Guises have lost their power. Mary Queen of Scots is in a darkened room. Great so far, but our Facebook status with Scotland has just gone to, it's complicated. The Scotty Lords are now waiting for their Queen's next moves. In England, our treasurer will die, meaning musical chairs for jobs, and Cecil will score Master of the Wards. That's a job we all want, so Cecil's gone from, poor me, I might resign, to Top of the Pops, and yes, he's happy again. January 1561, and Robert Dudley with his brother-in-law, Sir Henry Sidney, will go to the Spanish ambassador. Here's what they've got to say. Betty wants to marry Robert. If you can get Spanish Phil to back this marriage, then Robert and Betty will make England Catholic again. Ambassador will say,
you shitting me?
Yeah, no, says Dudley. Betty's right behind this idea. Look, she can't raise it with you, but if you ask her, then you'll find I'm right. The ambassador will say, look, you guys need to be Catholic because it's the one true religion and not because of some political ambition to marry yourself onto the big chair. But if you're fair dinkum, then I'm into this little scheme. Off goes the ambassador to see Betty, who will be all coy. Yes, well, you see, it's like this, I don't know. He's rather hunky. Have you seen his legs? And what about his tight ass? I suppose, well, you know, marrying Robert would be okay. I don't know. It may be. Perhaps sort of fun, but I haven't made up my mind, really, about him or anyone else. But what is this all about? Nobody knows except Betty herself. It does look like Betty wanted to marry Dudley, but she knew it was a bad idea. She needed to get the word out somehow that marriage was a bit on the cards so that hopefully a number of nobles would come forward and say, hey, good idea, Betty. That won't happen. It looks like William Herbert, the Earl of Pembroke, was the only guy in favour. Throckmorton and Tom Howard absolutely against. The rest will just sulk. Not willing to support Dudley, and not willing to risk their futures by opposing the Queen's favourite. Nothing has been decided, and Betty just looks indecisive. Dudley's trying to whip up some support. Now, the Council of Trent is about to reconvene. That's the papal response to the Reformation talkfest thingy that's been going on for fucking years. If you might recall, Ridge Pole was part of it, but he's dead now, of course. Dudley will promise the Spanish ambassador that he will get a delegation from England to attend. He's sucking up to the Catholic faction. Dudley's getting serious, but Betty may not be. All she's done is and be all coy, but the Betty we can see from our position in the future just loves games and diplomacy and intrigue. All that stuff, so she might be just toying with Dudley and the Spanish ambassador both. She will get Cecil on the case to finish this part of the intrigue. Cecil will tell the ambassador we want Phil to write and say that Betty should get married soon and that she should choose one of her own Englishmen to marry. Now, Dudley will see this as the step before he can actually marry Betty. To up the ante, Dudley will say, "Marry me or let me go and be a mercenary for Phil." That might be a mistake there, Dudley, because it looks like Betty will say no to the marriage and, sure, if you want to go and get yourself killed, fuck off and go and get yourself killed. Because of Dudley's intrigue, we'll now see a papal nuncio hanging around in Brussels looking for an English passport to come and talk to Betty about that delegation to go to the Council of Trent. The last thing we need right now is religious controversy. It upsets people. The Spanish ambassador is chatting to conservative Catholic big dicks in England, and Cecil is trying to send him to the Archbishop of Canterbury so they can sit in a quiet little room and argue theology by themselves. Letters are coming in to Betty, saying, "Hey, Queen, don't be going back to that Catholic stuff. Look what happened with Mary. We don't want that shit again." Cecil will pounce, nabbing a chaplain to Sir Edward Waldegrave, who had been one of Mary's guys. "And look, it's an incriminating letter, and we'll be having a little chat which will get us a couple more of Mary's guys, plus Ridgepole's nephew, Arthur Pole. Yeah, we'll be having long chats with these guys, and we can get enough to do them on violating religious statutes. They will have to say sorry by paying a fine and take the oath of supremacy that Betty is top of the pops for English churchy types." It's a bit of a stitch-up, and it's more about Cecil keeping the Catholics on their toes and letting Betty know there's troublemakers about. The council will unanimously say, "Do not let that papal nuncio into England. They're just troublemakers, those Pope guys. Look, just the rumour that he was coming has led to those 4 arrests and fines. It's disturbed the peace." Robert Dudley has come out of this rather well. He's lost the main prize, which was marriage to Betty, and his intrigue with the Spanish ambassador went nowhere, but his position as favourite is rock solid. He's gotten away with it all. His promises to the Catholics were, as usual, post-dated and meant nothing. Joe Biden said, "Vote me in 2 Democrat senators in Georgia and that will be an immediate payment of $2,000 for you." Suckers in Georgia voted in the 2 senators and now Joe's sort of finding it a little bit difficult to send out $2,000 to anybody. Well, to be fair, just like all other US presidents, he finds about $1.4 million a minute to spend on bombs and soldiers and shit. So it's a bit hard to find money to spend on ordinary people if you've got to spend all that money on war. If the Catholics had helped him get married, then he would no doubt have found it a bit difficult to make England Catholic again. Cecil has shown us that he's firmly Protestant out of all this, but not like the more rabid Protestants who see England as being the Protestant capital of the universe, the nation to forge a Protestant alliance with the Scotties and the Huguenots. And what about the Germans, you might be asking, my dear listener? Well, they're mostly Lutherans, and we think Lutherans are weird. Or they're Anabaptists, and nobody likes the Anabaptists. Or the Zwinglians, and the Calvinists are a bit on the nose. And, oh, look, it's an Abrahamic faith where the one constant thing is we don't agree with you. Cecil has also reinserted himself as leader of the council by getting their unanimous support to refuse the papal nuncio. His dick swingeth bigly. The only matter he didn't tidy up was the removal of Dudley. Now, Betty is a tricky one to understand in all this. She let her feelings out, and we don't really like a monarch that's got feelings. She looked like she might risk it all for the love of Robert Dudley, but did keep listening to her counsellors. And that might be the difference between Betty and, say, Ted too, with his darlings, Pierce fucking Gaveston and Hugh Dispenser the cunt. Ted booted his counsellors out, and it all ended badly. Betty, though, kept on listening. Billy stayed a bit aloof from it all while allowing Dudley to intrigue with the Spanish ambassador. Billy herself just hinted at stuff and made no commitments, then read the room, saw the nobles weren't happy with Dudley as husband. But they made no move on him as favourite, they were happy to kind of let that slide. Her religion also remains a bit obscure to us at the moment. If we were to go to a royal chapel, we'd see a crucifix and candlesticks. Protestants aren't happy with that, but Betty likes it. This may just be Betty sending them a message. Stuff your ideological rigidity. I'll do it my way. Keeping the Latin thingies shows she's keeping the options open. The English, like most of Europe, are drawing sharp lines, Catholic and Protestant. Betty, like Henry before her, seems to want blurred lines to give her greater flexibility. This whole affair has been a shake-up for the English court. These guys share to some extent the views of John Knox about female rulers, and no doubt some of our English think John Knox didn't go far enough. And I suppose, speaking of John Knox, we might as well get him up to date. John had written to Mary of Guise when she took over as regent of Scotland. He wanted her to change the religious policy. Now, John Knox is not very good at writing to government leaders or governments seeking things like change in policy. He'll be just telling Mary of Guise she's on the path to eternal torment and pain, and he's just letting her know that, because any subject would let her know that if he saw her going down the path to hell that she's on. Trouble was, he was just telling her what she's doing wrong and not saying what he actually wants. We don't know what he wants. Letter can be filed in the bin. No, of course it won't. It will be preserved, otherwise how could I be telling you this? 1556. Good news for Mary of Guise. John Knox is back off to Geneva, where he still has a post as preacher and pastor. Bad news for Mary of Guise. John Knox is, I'll be back. In Geneva, the churchy stuff will go well for him. He can chat with the top guys and the theological bullshit can be spread nice and thick. John Knox, though, will have problems with domestic bliss. He just doesn't know how to do it. His experience is celibate priest, tutor, galley slave and itinerant preacher. Now he's got to be the head of a household that has his wife and mother-in-law. Yes, we're still suspicious about the mother-in-law. Plus he's got a couple of students and a servant or two. He just wants a bit of peace and bloody quiet to write a nice sermon of hellfire and damnation. For John Knox, it has to be the Lord's work first, so the woman will just have to cope. Won't be long, though, before Marjorie's up the spout. At least the social life is good, or whatever word you want to use for a bunch of people who are tied together by religion rather than sex, drugs and rock and roll. Marjorie will be John's secretary and be part of a female network of English Protestant exiles. Marjorie will give John two sons and then can die. Now, the exiles got a regular report from England, who's gone to the slammer, who's gone to the stake, who's recanted and gone to the dark side of the force. They will develop the language of soldiers and become soldiers of Christ in a battle against evil. They can't actually do anything by sitting in Geneva except get angry. Angry John Knox will start using language like the holy hatred. The chief subject of the holy hatred will be our Queen Mary and Philip of Spain. The Catholics will sweep into Strasbourg and nab Protestant Sir John Cheek. They can take him back to England and the Tower, where our friendly Catholic torturers are ready to help him convert back to the true faith, and convert back he does. That's a big blow for the exiles, and worse, are we all at risk of being nabbed by English agents? We have to start thinking about how we would hold up under torture, or worse, being set on fire. The nab of Sir John will see a sharp decrease in the Protestant pamphlets coming into England. But John Knox's congregation want action, action. We want action. A-C-T-I-O-N. John will have them working on weapons, like another translation of the magic book, liturgical stuff, a metrical psalter, and whatever else will be handy to fight the Antichrist. The new translation will be that Geneva Bible. If you do happen to look at one, you will see the title page is God, through Moses, parting the Red Sea. Our mob think that God's going to do that for them too. He won't. In Exodus 14, where the thing happens, they will put in extra notes to point out that God always, always comes through to deliver the people who belong to the true church of God. He doesn't. Here's a sample of what you might find in the Geneva Bible. In this figure, four chief points are to be considered. First, that the church of God is ever subject in this world to the cross and to be afflicted after one sort of another. The second, that the ministers of God following their vocation shall be evil spoken of and murmured against, even of them that pretend the same cause and religion that they do. The third, that God delivered not his church incontinently out of dangers, but to exercise their faith and patience, continued their troubles, yea, and oftentimes augmented them, as the Israelites were now in less hope of their lives than when they were in Egypt. The fourth point is that when the dangers are most great, then God's help is most ready to succour. For the Israelites had on either side of them huge rocks and mountains, and before them the sea, and behind them most cruel enemies, so that there was no way left to escape to man's judgment. Here, yeah, apart from the absolute crap writing that might be John Knox himself, it's all about life really fucking sucks and God's always kicking you in the nuts just so he can pull your ass out the fire at the last minute. But as soon as he pulls your ass out the fire, he's back to kicking you in the nuts again. Oh, fuck all that. Tell God to kick the Antichrist in the ball sack. That'd be a better idea. John Knox is keen to get back to Scotland. He'll get as far as Dieppe in France, where some of his countrymen will cause him to just pause and think about it. Now, France itself isn't a good place for him at the moment because it's time to persecute the Huguenots. John can take up the pen again. It's being mightier than the sword, and write the first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women. That ensures that women like Mary Tudor, Mary Guise, Mary Colleen of Scots, and our own dear Betty will not be looking at John Knox in a friendly manner at all. He does want to go to Scotland, and to help this, he's in touch with the underground Protestant church, a.k.a. the French Protestant communities, a.k.a. the Huguenots. These guys are a bit like the resistance types in World War II with their secret contacts, and they can move people around without the authorities knowing. The French were experts at this type of mission, how to proselyse and survive amid persecution. The Scotties are pretty mild on religious stuff, but John Knox is still on the wanted list. He's been condemned in absentia and his effigy burned in the marketplace at Edinburgh. If he goes back to Scotland, they might just decide to burn the real John Knox. It's also a lot harder to go back now that Mary's in charge in England. She'd be pretty much certain to set him on fire. Meantime, the Scotties will just have to put up with letters from John promising to come home. March 1557, he gets a letter saying, "Hey John, are you just a bit chicken to come back?" He'll write back saying how he prays daily that he can come back to Scotland to see his beloved sheep, or flock, whatever you call the thing. Now, getting back to Scotland from Geneva is tricky. You need to go through the lowlands and that Spanish-filled territory. John Knox has said some rather unkind things about Spanish Phil. Just to help out further, it's currently a bit of a war zone with Phil fighting the Frenchies. He's about to have his big win at St. Quentin. If John can get through the lowlands, then he'll end up in France again, where Henri has just gone full metal anti-heresy. One king, one faith. Yeah, Catholic. John Knox will do a sneaky trip and get into Dieppe in France, where the Scotties were supposed to have people and resources waiting for him. But it's just letters saying, look, bit tricky right now. Another letter saying, "Hey John, some nobles have unfriended you on Facebook. Yeah, it's all getting a bit complicated, mate." They will get a good spray back, including that God is about to fuck them right over for letting Mary Queen of Scots marry Frankie Snotface. And I could still be in Geneva right now, snorting crap from a hooker's ass. Then he'll end up by saying, "Hey, this is just a friendly warning." But that's where we'll be leaving John Knox until next week. He's hiding in France and it's all a bit risky for him. Jet Harrison, Tony Meehan with Diamonds there to get us into some historical fiction. Tony Meehan, of course, mentioned last week, he was the drummer who inspired Mick Fleetwood to get into his drum kit. Jet Harris had been the bass player for the Shadows, decided he wanted to do a bit of lead guitar, and of course that Hank Marvin said, no way, fuck off, mate, I'm the lead guitarist in the Shadows, so piss off, do your own thing. But Jet Harris did. There was some stuff about Cliff Richards was banging his missus as well. It all got a bit messy. But off he went for a little brief career there and then descended into a life of alcoholism. There you go. That's my cheery story for that little particular venture. But it's about historical fiction, and I had a crack at the second novel in the Cuthbert series by John Broughton. And I really enjoyed this one. We've skipped ahead about five generations or something. So we're in the time of the Great Heathen Invasion and all that sort of messy stuff. I just really enjoy reading about the old Anglo-Saxon days. So this one was called The Horse Thane by John Broughton. And if you want to have a read of these, I think you can pick them up at Amazon very, very cheap if you are a Kindle reader or something like that. So John Broughton, The Horse Thane. But for us, it's a matter of what we go out with. And we kicked off with J.S. Bach airing out his G-string, and then in about 1967, a band called Procol Harum nicked it and turned it into a thing called Whiter Shade of Pale. So why don't we go out with a bit of Whiter Shade of Pale? I think we should. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
At first just go sleep. Turn